Session number 9956.
Michael Irwin, Reel 3. You were telling me about when the HX-72 was attacked and how you saw the similar blow-up. You said you normally hear that was the only one you saw blow-up.
Yeah.
What impression did it make on you when you saw this?
Well, that was the first ship, and I think she was an oil burner. I think that's why she... an oil tanker. She was Norwegian, there was just a sheet of flame. And then... it was reported from the telegraph room that there'd been SOSs here and there, and I think there were seven ships, something like that, sunk that night. It was the following convoy where they were shelled. No, and we then carried on, but it was, in fact, this my captain reported. We went into Londonderry, and my captain reported, and it's in the Battle of Atlantic book, which is a very good book, it was his view that the submarines had gone in between the columns of the inside the convoy itself, and it wasn't believed by the Admiralty. But, of course, don't forget they'd broken our code. They knew our position and everything else.
What about... was there any panic amongst the convoy when this hitherto unprecedented scale of...
Not to my knowledge. Torpedoes. Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, there was a complaint put up by our Captain Knapp of lights. There was one ship that was showing lights, but there was no panic to my knowledge, no.
I don't know whether you saw Knapp during the time he was trying to cope with this problem. How did they try and... I mean, what were the escort doing?
Well, the escort, in fact, completely in the wrong place. They were proceeding further away from the convoy and to the stern of the convoy when the submarines went inside the convoy. So and firing, we were firing star shell most of the time, which was completely ineffective. And I suppose when near the convoy, it illuminated the convoy.
So there was, from what you saw, there was no real realization of how to cope with the wolf pack tactic and the getting in amongst the convoy
right.
At that time.
No way at all, no.
Just bafflement.
This is complete bafflement, yes. And he recommended that action should be taken, putting a ship in the middle of a convoy or something like that, but I don't think a notice was taken of it at the time.
Did you talk about what had happened in the wardroom?
Oh, yes. Oh, continuously. Yes. Oh, yes.
So what sort of things were being said?
I suppose it was a general conversation as to, you know, why didn't we have more escorts? Because escorts were very rare at that time. I mean...
How many did you have with you?
To my knowledge, there'd be probably... Well, yes, Skeener. We had a Canadian destroyer. She was damn good. Excellent. We had... I don't remember any British destroyer. I think the Skeener was... I have all the records, of course. But there would be La Malouine, which would be a trawler. Mostly trawlers, sloops, but very few destroyers.
Now, the next convoy you went on, there was more trouble.
Well, yes.
Which number was that?
I think it was SC-2. SC-2 or SC-7. SC-2, in my view. It was the following month. I have the dates down in we went into Londonderry and then refueled and out we came into the Atlantic again. And this time the convoy scattered. It had been mauled before we'd arrived, but it was in order. And during the night it scattered. They all broke apart.
What was the cause of that?
Well, there'd been so many ships sunk. And I assume that... I don't think there was any order given to scatter, but I assume they'd lost contact and ill discipline, perhaps. All I do know, and I do remember very well, was a ship called the Leadgate, and she was a Considine Company ship, which I had been in 1935, 36, and she was carrying... she was trading between the Tyne and Spain. Now, she was carrying iron ore from the USA, which was fantastic, a ship of 2,500, 3,000 tons. And I well remember when dawn came, the only ship that we saw was the Ledgate, and I knew the captain. And this was 500 miles out or so in the Atlantic, and I was able to speak to the captain, and Captain, I can't remember, Walker or something like that, nice man. And this was quite extraordinary. And then on the horizon, this I do recall vividly, it was either the Canonessa or the Collegian. And this ship was being shelled by a U-boat. I think she'd been torpedoed and hadn't sunk. And you could see these flashes of like lightning on the horizon. And then suddenly a Sunderland flying boat came over and it stopped. The submarine submerged. Well, I contacted the U-boat commander, Jeselnik, after the war, and I have a letter from him giving full details of the attack. And he mentions this Sunderland flying boat. Well, you can imagine, with a scattered convoy all on one's own, it was a tremendous relief to see this Sunderland flying boat. I don't think the Canonessa or was it Collegian, one of the two. I don't think it was. It may have sunk. I don't know.
How many of these? Was that the only two Atlantic convoys
yes,
you did?
Yes. Yes.
And then back to the East Coast.
And then back to the East Coast. And I've spoken to many people, ex-servicemen, naval, and they went right through the war without seeing any action in the Atlantic at all. And we did too. Quite extraordinary it was. But and then back to the East Coast. Yes.
To talk about convoy discipline, you were only a very junior, you're
That's
now
right.
a sub-lieutenant, but did you notice anything about convoy discipline, about the way the merchant marine performed in these convoys?
I think they were superb in the Atlantic. I don't know why that convoy scattered, but I think that they were the bravest, and their discipline was good, particularly in the big ships.
Were they good at keeping station, according
not
to...
Not always, not always. Very difficult when you're zigzagging. Very difficult. And there were an awful lot of collisions. On the East Coast, there was a terrible collision with the Jarvis, a Dutch ship. It wasn't, it was a Swedish ship off Blyth, off the coast here. This Jarvis, the destroyer, and the Swedish ship collided, and there was great loss of life on both sides. I also, on East Coast, zigzagging, the Captain Knapp came up one middle watch, I think it was, and he said, Erwin, just later on in the war, in 1940, well, what is our position now? And I was frightened of him. I'd just given starboard 20 or starboard 10 on the starboard side of the zigzag, and I went in under the little hatch cover and was giving him the position when I suddenly realized, thank heaven, terrible, that I'd given the order to go to starboard. And I said, excuse me, sir, and I went out, and here we were. The starboard lookout hadn't bothered at all to warn me, I suppose the captain on the bridge, and we were going right into the convoy, and it was an immediate harder port, and we avoided collision, but there were collisions, a lot of collisions. A lot of collisions.
How did you go about steering a zigzag course at night? You're now a fully-fledged officer of the watch. How did you go about it? What techniques would you use?
Well, there was a diagram. There were several diagrams as to you'd last 5 minutes or 10 minutes on a particular course, and then you'd alter course to port or to starboard, whichever it might be. Mostly on the East Coast, to my recollection, the convoy would not zigzag. It was the escort that zigzagged. But perhaps they did. I can't really remember. Perhaps they did zigzag. But certainly in the Atlantic they did, which was damn dangerous. I mean, you know this story of the Curacao and was it the Queen Elizabeth? You must know that one. Well, there was this cruiser, light cruiser. She, in fact, I saw the Queen Elizabeth. She had a bow dent, and she warned the captain of this cruiser. He was coming too close, zigzagging in front of him, and of this Queen Elizabeth, because the Queen Elizabeth went straight. I don't think she zigzagged at all. Her speed was a saver. And the captain ignored it, and he actually rammed the Curacao and both halves went down the side, and the Queen Elizabeth couldn't stop. So there were vast casualties. But there were a lot of terribly sad collisions and groundings.
How did you allow for... you said that you'd go according to a diagram, 5 minutes one way and 5 minutes the other. How would you allow for drift and things like that? I'm thinking of when the prevailing wind and tides and things...
Oh, I don't think that mattered at all, to my recollection. I think you... as I say, certainly this is the night time and we nearly had that awful collision. The little blue lights on the bridge... I don't think you took any notice of drift or anything like that. I think when you got... There was a big minefield on the outer side of where you were proceeding, north or south. There was a big minefield. For example, I remember we'd also have MTBs came out to help us as well. And I remember in the winter of 40, there would be such and such an aircraft missing. And then you'd see a flare. That was another sad thing. You'd see a flare go up, obviously men in dinghies, damn cold, but you couldn't do anything about it because you couldn't cross the minefield. They would be outside of the minefield. They'd bailed out or landed in the sea. That happened once. Oh, I think it was dangerous work, but there we are.
Now, look, what were conditions like on board the ship? You were only on a small sloop.
That's right.
Not a big boat, and in the North Sea, during winter at one point. How was it?
It was very uncomfortable, but not so uncomfortable. We were very lucky, sloops. They were comfortable ships. The V and W destroyers were the 1418 war destroyers, and they, I think they were fantastic, the people that served on board there. Many a man was lost overboard, not from on the sloops, though. I think they had to... You couldn't proceed from aft. The wardroom was aft, if I remember rightly, right aft in the V&Ws, and you had to come up and proceed on the upper deck to get to the bridge, whereas we could go through the mess rooms to the bridge without going on the outside. So we were very lucky, but they had terrible casualties.
Were you thrown about at all?
Oh, I think so, yes. Oh, yes. I have letters from one man who said we went, was it 60 degrees over in the Atlantic, and he was terrified. We were all terrified we might go over. I can't remember that particular occasion. Our captain, and I suppose I shouldn't say this, was known as Von Knapp by the ratings. He was a tough, tough character.
Was the ship watertight?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes, very much so.
So you wouldn't get the leaking problem you had in some destroyers?
No. It was comfortable. We haven't got used to it. I used to be sick to start with, but then at the end, no.
Were you overcrowded?
I would say yes. I'd say the crew's quarters, most certainly. Most certainly.
What about your own quarters?
Our quarters were pretty good.
Were you on your own, or...?
Yes, I was. I was in the cabin of my own, yes. We were well catered for. Very well catered for.
Now, after the East Coast, you went... Where did you go?
What happened on the East Coast was an interesting thing, in that we were proceeding south. It was January the 13th, to my knowledge. January the 3rd or January the 13th. And... there was a convoy coming out of the Thames, and we were going south into the Thames. And you had to, with the narrow channel, you had to go in single line. So we were proceeding in single line, and we were the fourth ship, in effect, to go over an acoustic mine. As you know, the acoustic mine was worked by the propellers of ships. And so it was flat calm, and we were... comfortably mined. By that I mean that I had had Christmas leave, and I had by then got fed up with this ship. I wanted to move, and I said to my
mind, "Why were you fed up?"
Well, we'd had a year of pretty hard going, you know. And I was only or 20. And I said to my mother, I hope we'll be comfortably mined. And I met a girlfriend in Edinburgh. I was going to take her to The Dancing Years by Ivor Novello, which I never did. But anyway, we were blown up by this acoustic mine. We had one or two badly injured, but nobody killed. And
where were you when the mine went off?
Well, I was up in the director. I lost some teeth and I had a gash over my leg, but not badly wounded. The captain, he had a new Cape Hawk life jacket, a brand new one from Gives, must have cost him the earth. And there was a rating who was painting the inside of the bridge with white paint. And I must say, I laughed like hell, poor fellow, when it was blown up, because he was all white with his new Cape Hawk life jacket. But the ship was towed in to Chatham, to dry dock, and it sank during the night in the dry dock. The pumps couldn't cope. They were frozen up. And they kept in the wardroom. It was underneath the wardroom. This was flooded. My cabin, well, I was forcing in the director, otherwise I'd have been killed. My cabin was in a hell of a mess. But there was one interesting thing happened. My father, my mother was in Newcastle, and she was friendly with an army colonel who worked at Vickers. It wasn't army, it was marine. And he was on leave in London, or outside Southend or somewhere. And he went into a pub that night, and he met a pilot who said to him that he had seen a ship blow up, and the ship was HMS Lowestoft. Now, the colonel knew that I was in HMS Lowestoft, and the bloody fool rang my mother and said, "Have you any news of Michael? Is he all right?" And that was the first indication she knew that Lowestoft had been blown up. And it was only hours later when I was able to telephone and say that, all was well. There was no announcement on the news. They always announced on the news in those days. It seemed to me crazy, awful, that HMS so-and-so was blown up. Because, I don't know, they had time to inform all the relatives. But that was when we were blown up. And I was then ordered to see that all the gin and the whiskey was poured down the sink, which was terrible. I learnt afterwards that only recently from one of the ratings that they managed to smuggle a lot ashore.
So what happened next then?
Well, the most amusing thing was that I was on survivor's leave, and I received my call-up papers in Newcastle when I was on leave, because I was 21, March the 1st. So I went down to the call-up headquarters in Newcastle, and expressed the hope that I could join in my civvies, and expressed the hope that I could join the Navy. And there was a young man there, of probably about 25, who told me that I would go where I was told. So I led him on up the path, and then I told him in no mean terms that I was wanted to know why the hell he wasn't fighting, and I gave him a bit of a bollocking on that score. To which he said, "Are you an officer?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you're certainly not a gentleman using that language in front of my secretary." But however, I was sent, because of my knowledge of French, to take over the second in command of the Bristol Channel balloon barrage. Now, it must have been the day before I arrived, one of these craft, fishing vessels, was mined, and the whole lot were blown up. These fishing vessels were manned by Flemish seamen under T-124X agreement. They were under special agreement. And they put a cage onto these trawlers, fishing vessels. There'd be three or four of the Flemish seamen, and there'd be three or four RAF. And they put a cage and a balloon, and off Flatholm, I think it was, in the Bristol Channel, one of these was mined. And they immediately came straight into Barry, where they were based, and refused to go out again. And I can't blame them. Having been mined myself, I was rather happy not to have to do that job. So I became involved in the maintenance of these trawlers, fishing vessels, and also There were trawlers, RN trawlers that came in, so I had to maintain those as well and be responsible to Neil Ross in charge of Barry. Well, then they decided that they would give me a special job, and there were two neutral ships, the Falkvik, Swedish, and the Turul, she was Panamanian. So they were suspected, they were of rendezvousing with German submarines. Now, they took coal from Newport round to Devonport and Falmouth. And they went on their own. And, of course, the rates of pay for these men were terrific. But because I spoke Swedish, they put me in on this job and gave me a revolver. What use it would be, I really don't know. I used to do that. Well, I remember one occasion, the Falkvik, the captain, was absolutely drunk as a coot when I joined him, and he said the steering chains were out of order. Would I please tell the agent, the shipping agent, who happened to be our agent when I'm in civilian job, Mr. Heath, that it was dangerous to go to sea. Mr. Heath was only about 10 years older than I, and he said, no, when you will see that it goes to sea, Admiralty orders. Well, we went to sea, the steering chains broke, we nearly capsized, we had coal, we had a near miss from a convoy, the captain's cook chopped his thumb off. He saved the ship by virtue of closing the hatches. There was a tarpaulin across the hatch and wooden timber, and he saved that ship. Brilliant man. But I've always felt very aggrieved to Mr. Heath, who had a job ashore. The Falkvik put into Falmouth on that occasion, and the Turul I took round several times, and to Devonport. And that was when Devonport was bombed, very, very badly bombed. And in fact, I believe the Turul did receive a direct hit.
So your job was to make sure that they didn't meet
rendezvous with German submarines, which is crazy, of course.
So you were meant to, with your revolver.
Well, yes, it's absolutely absurd, and there was no question.
Was there any sign in while you were with these ships that they might have done that if you hadn't been aboard, or that
None
they might
all.
Have done it in the past, or was this
no.
just
that's somebody's crazy idea? The sort of thing that did happen, though, is that I suppose it happened on East Coast, is that if you would the Admiralty would tell you that going south, that such and such a lighthouse would the light would be up between 1 o'clock and say 1:30 whilst you were passing, but of course the steering chains broke, and we were dead duck, and the navigation was just impossible. But that was one of the jobs that I had to do.
This was while you were
at Barry.
You were still nominally in charge of the, or second in charge of the balloon barrage, were
Yes,
you?
Well...
But this wasn't taking place at all.
This wasn't taking place, no. There was in Barry at that time the famous ship, now known, very famous, Fidelity. She was a cruise ship, and it had a mad Frenchman as captain, and one of the spies... remember his name, Belgian, he got the George Cross, was landed from her. We used to meet them in a pub. I used to go out to St. Athens and fly a bit there, but then I got so fed up, I said, please send me back to sea. And I used to go up to London to the Naval Assistant Second Sea Lord, NA2SL, to plead to send me back to sea. It was after the Bismarck battle, and I felt I was wasting... Well, I had a good rest, put it that way. I was there for about 9 months, more than that, much more. I think it was about 10 months.
Is there anything you remember about that? I know you were on cruise ships later, yes. But that particular cruise ship, or its captain, any more detail about
that? No, the captain of Fidelity, they were all lost eventually. The ship was lost, the whole lot was lost, other than the spy who was captured by the Germans. But she was repaired. She was in Barry, and this Fidelity's captain... His girlfriend sailed, and they had I always remember they had a special bathroom put in. But, no, it was a very traumatic time, that. Right? Yeah, the one of my jobs was to keep our charts up to date. You got orders to for charts to be, you know, every week to put up there. Well, I didn't do that. It was a bloody nuisance as far as I was concerned, and I was very lucky because one night Cardiff was bombed, and now I lived on Barry Island, and my headquarters was in a little shed by the locks. And I well recall the night when an aircraft must have been hit over Cardiff, and it came very, very low over the lock gates, and it dropped a bomb right on my office. It was quite close to us. Well, that was the best thing that could ever happen, because the Admiralty had to issue new charts. So all the work that I should have done, I'd have been in trouble if it hadn't been for that German airman. So then, as I say, I used to go up to London, and would they please send
me... Did you have any other jobs to do besides that?
No, not really, no. And I went up to London and said, please send me back to sea. And I remember one night going, when I went up to London, I took, instead of taking my gas mask, inside my gas mask, I took my pajamas. Father was in London, and it was at a nightclub I met him with Sutcliffe and Cat's Eye Cunningham, the great night fighter pilot. We had a party, and I turned in. Father had a room in the Piccadilly, and I remember that the Piccadilly was hit that night, and we didn't know anything about it at all. But eventually, they decided, the Admiralty in their wisdom, that they'd get rid of me, and they appointed me to this city of Durban. Now, that could have been in January. Certainly, I think it must have been before February, December, January. And so you took the Jellicoe, which was the train from London up to Scarpa, Thurso. Is it Thurso? Yes, up at the north. It was called the Jellicoe. It used to leave London and call in Newcastle, and all these sailors would go on board, and they were bound for Scarpa Flow. The Dunluce Castle was the passenger ship at Big Liner, which at Scarpa, where you waited for onward passage. So we went, I joined HMS Calpe, which is a destroyer, Hunt-class destroyer, with a Norwegian saboteur, spy, wireless operator, call him what you will, and we arrived at Sullivan in the Shetlands. And there were two ships, the Cape Sable and the City of Durban, and they were disguised as blockade runners, all sorts of funny paint marks on the side of the ship. And I thought, what the hell have I arrived at? And I got on board, and there was Captain Hopper, very, very finest commanding officer I've ever met, RN, a lot of the Linger Company. They were the Norwegian commandos, our own commandos, and she had 8 4-inch guns, 4 torpedo tubes, and about 40 depth charges. She was half oil, half coal. And the Cape Sable was similarly placed. She was, except I think she was only coal burning. And the object was to go to a place called Harstad in the north of Norway and to blow up the German and Norwegian ships that were supplying the German front line right at the very north of Norway. What's the name of the place, you know, up at the very north of Norway? Well, the front line was up there, Russian front line. I should know it. Anyway, this was in almost the Arctic Circle, and these ships would come up between the islands and then anchor there, and then the bigger ships would go out to sea, and we were to go in and to blow them up, and also a herring oil factory. It was an absolute crazy idea. The Tirpitz was further north. I don't know how we would have got away. One of my jobs was to have a depth charge and to go into a motorboat and to drop it underneath these ships. Well, I think the object, really, the reason I was there was because I spoke Swedish, but I don't think many others did, other than the Norwegians. How we would have escaped to Norway, I really don't know. But anyway, we sailed, and we...
Had you done any training for
none,
this?
None at all. I think that, obviously, it was that night we sailed, so, I mean, I was lucky to be on the operation. They may have trained the I suppose the Norwegians had, the Linger Company,